This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
January 24th, a Twitch live stream, an 18-year-old singer and a 13-year-old girl laughing, talking into the early morning hours, sitting next to each other on camera for the world to see. And then near the end, he looks over, laughs, and says two words, delete everything. Delete everything. Those words didn't delete anything. The live stream is archived, the relationship it captured kept going, allegedly. And 14 months later, according to prosecutors, the girl sitting next to him in that video, a child named Celeste Rivas Hernandez, 13 at the time, walked into his Hollywood Hills home and was never seen or heard from again. Her name was Celeste. She was from Lake Elsinore, California. Her parents immigrated from El Salvador. She was reported missing three separate times in the final year of her life. And the man prosecutors allege is responsible for her death, David Anthony Burke, the 21-year-old now singer known professionally as David D4VD, has now been formally charged with her murder. Your thoughts in the comment section as we work our way through the latest in this story, and I guess the inevitable of what has finally transpired, with charges now being brought against Burke that aren't just severe. They tell a story. And the story the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office is telling is one of calculation, silence, and self-preservation at the cost of a child's life. Now, I want to caution everybody, we're going to go through all of the charges. I'm going to say this, and it's in no way trying to stand up for David, but we are at the very beginning of this case. I know it's been dragging on forever, but truly, now that charges have been brought, we are at the very beginning of the new chapter in the case, I should say. We've turned a page. We've turned a leaf. We're going in a new direction here. And anytime this happens, anytime you have charges being brought by a district attorney, by a prosecutor, they basically have the stage right now. Whatever they're going to say, the full attention of the audience is on them. There's no one on that stage at this moment saying, I don't think so. Whoa. Hold on a second here. What you're saying, we don't agree with. We don't think that that's true. Now, that could be because someone's defending someone who's guilty, or could be because someone's defending somebody who is not guilty. Someone who has a story that the DA's version of events may not be completely accurate to reality. That's why we have courts. That's why this is likely going to go to trial at some point in time. So both sides can present their case and say, here's why we think we're innocent. Here's why we think you're guilty. And then it's up to a jury of his peers, 12 people, to decide who they actually believe. But in the noise of all of this, at this moment in time, it is the stage of the DA and the prosecution. They're bringing the charges, and it sounds pretty nasty, and it sounds pretty horrible. But before we make a full judgment here on anything, let's hear what he has to say. The defense of David has said that they have not gotten all of their discovery materials yet. Prosecution saying there's like 40-some terabytes of digital information, which, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to be pretty damning if there's some stuff on there that points to guilt. Digital trails, Google histories, text messages, emails, all of it, all of that. If there's stuff within that that points to David being, number one, calculating, planning the death of Celeste, number two, the cover-up of what happened to her and the motive behind all of that. The DA seems to think that they got quite a case here, so much so that they're saying this was done to further his career. Not like killing somebody's going to help you go further in life, but more so killing somebody will prevent someone from not going further in life. Meaning if information were to come out that an adult is having a relationship with a child, that might hinder one's musical career or ticket sales or album sales. At least you'd think it would. I mean, yeah, we got a great track record in this country of supporting folks like that. Well into the darkness. At a press conference on April 20th, 2026, DA Nathan Hochman stood alongside LAPD Chief Jim McDonnell and laid out the most serious charges his office can bring. First-degree murder with special circumstances. Continuous S abuse of a minor. Lewdness S acts with an individual under the age of 14. Mutilation of human remains. Hochman called it a brutal and horrific act. And, it wasn't wrong. But the special circumstances attached to the big charge of murder are where the prosecution's theories become something more than a charge sheet. They become a motive map, if you will. The first special circumstance, lying in wait. That's the prosecution saying this was not a flash of rage, not an accident, not a moment of panic. They're alleging premeditation, that Burke planned what allegedly happened inside that house. The second, murder for financial gain. And Hochman was blunt about what that means. He stated directly that the financial gain was for Burke to maintain his very lucrative music career, a career that Celeste was reportedly threatening on the night of April 23rd, 2025. According to prosecutors, a 14-year-old girl's knowledge of their relationship, her ability to speak about it publicly, her existence as a living witness to what was allegedly happening between them, all of it treated as a liability, at least that's according to the prosecution, a threat to streams, record deals, brand partnerships, world tour. The prosecution is alleging that her life was weighed against his career, and his career won. The third, taking out a witness in an investigation. Celeste herself was the witness. The S relationship between the minor and the adult. That was the underlying crime she could have testified to. Prosecutors allege she was reportedly silenced to make sure she never would. Connect those three special circumstances together, and it's like picture page, you know, with creepy Bill Cosby hosting, you know. Hey, kids, let's connect the dots here. Let's, you know. Remember picture page? Anybody have nightmares of picture page? You're like, that sounds familiar. Google it. Connect those three special circumstances together and prosecutors' theories become clear. Burke allegedly didn't harm Celeste despite who he was. He allegedly harmed her because of who he was and what he stood to lose if she ever spoke. That's the prosecution's theory. If convicted as charged, Burke faces life in prison without the possibility of parole or the death penalty. Hochman stated that the decision on whether his office will seek the death penalty will be made at a later date, but it's very much on the table. Now, before we get to what prosecutors alleged happened inside that house on April 23rd, it's worth understanding something about this relationship because it wasn't hidden. Pieces of it were sitting in plain sight across multiple platforms for years, visible to anyone who cared to look. Let's start with the digital trail. Celeste was reportedly a member of Burke's official Discord server as early as 2022. Other users on the server referred to a user named Celeste as Burke's girlfriend. That's not buried intelligence. That's a public chat room. Then came the January 24 Twitch live stream, Burke and Celeste on camera together, him laughing and telling her to delete everything. Between January and March of 24, Burke was photographed stepping out of a black Tesla just blocks from Celeste's family home in Lake Elsinore. CNN geolocated the and verified the timing of those alleged images. And by June of 24, Celeste was photographed backstage, allegedly at Burke's sold-out show at the Fonda Theater in Los Angeles. A private investigator later uncovered additional images that appear to show them together as recently as late December 24 and early January 25. They reportedly had matching tattoos, the inked on their right index fingers. Celeste's mother confirmed her daughter had a boyfriend named David. Her brother told NBC LA that Celeste went missing after Burke picked her up in his Tesla. Now, I have questions as to why you're letting a 13-year-old girl go out with a 19, 20-year-old man as a parent. I've addressed that already, and I think it's part of the story. This was not an invisible relationship. It was documented in live streams, photographs, Discord messages, tattoos, and family testimony. The question this case keeps forcing is not just what happened to Celeste. It's how something this visible went on for this long without anyone in a position of authority stepping in to protect a 13-year-old girl. Mom, Dad, I get you're grieving. That's horrible. I cannot imagine the shit you're going through. But there is a little thing called accountability. And just because tragedy strikes, it doesn't erase that from your fold. Because while all this was happening, Celeste was disappearing. She was reported missing three times in the final year of her life, according to the Riverside County Sheriff's Office. She last ran away on April of 24. She last contacted her family in May of 24. Surveillance footage and digital evidence confirmed she was still alive as late as September of 24 and January 25. Each time she was reported missing, the system had an opportunity to find her, to ask where she'd been, to follow the trail that was sitting right there in the open. Each time, that opportunity passed. LAPD Chief McDonald confirmed that Celeste was last known to be alive on April 23rd of 2025 when she arrived at Burke's Hollywood Hills home. 12 days earlier, on April 11th, Burke had stood on the Gobi stage at Coachella, one of the biggest music festivals on the planet, performing for thousands of fans during his debut at the festival. He attempted a backflip, face planted hard enough to nearly knock himself up, got up laughing, and finished the set. The moment went viral. He joked about it online afterward, promising to redeem himself the following weekend. Before that Coachella performance, Burke told People magazine he was moving very militant, very tactical, very intentional with his year. His debut album, Withered, was set to drop on April 25th, just 2 days after what prosecutors allege happened inside that house. The world tour was booked. The career was bursting. He was living the trajectory every young artist chases. And 12 days after that performance, according to prosecutors, a 14-year-old girl walked into his Hollywood Hills home. D.A. Hochman's words, she was never heard from again. Her body was found 5 months later, September 8th of 25, 1 day after what would have been Celeste's 15th birthday. Workers at a Hollywood tow yard called police after noticing a foul odor coming from an impounded Tesla registered to Burke. The vehicle had been abandoned on a street in the Hollywood Hills, not far from the rental property where Burke had been living, parked there for over a month before parking enforcement had it towed. When officers opened the front trunk, they found two bags. According to grand jury documents, one contained a decomposed head and torso. The other contained arms and legs. Where was David Anthony Burke when Celeste's remains were discovered? He was in Minneapolis. Minneapolis! Yes, that's a reference to the Janet Jackson song, really. Minneapolis! On a world tour, promoting his debut album. The album was called Withered. Let me tell you, he took people on an escapade. The spokesperson for Burke told NBC Los Angeles at the time that the singer was fully cooperating with the authorities. An LAPD source later told People magazine that this was allegedly not the case, that Burke had not been cooperative in the investigation. The gap between the public statement and the alleged reality is worth sitting with. According to TMZ, some of Burke's friends reportedly believe Celeste was a 19-year-old college student. And looking at her, you might guess that, too. After she was seen attending age-restricted events. If that's accurate, it raises its own set of questions about what Burke's inner circle knew, what they were told, and what they chose not to ask. The medical examiner ruled Celeste's death a homicide. The autopsy findings were sealed by a judge at the request of the LAPD, but Hochman indicated at the press conference that the coroner's report is expected to be released, revealing cause of death publicly for the first time since the case began. That moment, when we learn how Celeste died, will be a turning point in how the public understands what allegedly happened inside that house. Hochman also stated clearly that prosecutors have the goods, he claims, physical evidence and forensic and digital evidence that they intend to present in court to prove these charges beyond a reasonable doubt. McDonnell acknowledged that the investigation faced serious challenges. The substantial gap between Celeste's death and the discovery of her remains meant crucial evidence had degraded or disappeared. Detectives also had to work through a significant amount of false information that had been circulating publicly. But the charges filed suggest prosecutors believe they have enough, and then some. Burke's defense team, attorneys Blair Burke, Marilyn Benarski, and Regina Peter have stated they will vigorously defend his innocence. Their position laid out in a statement after his arrest, the actual evidence in this case will show that David Burke did not commit this act and was not the cause of Celeste's death. They noted prior to the charges being filed that no grand jury indictment had been returned, and that Burke had only been detained on suspicion. Those are experienced attorneys. Blair Burke has represented some of the biggest names in the entertainment industry. This defense will not be passive. But presumption of innocence is a legal standard, not a shield from scrutiny. And the charges filed against Burke, if the evidence supports them, paint a picture of something profoundly calculated, not passion, not panic, alleged premeditation, for self-preservation. Meanwhile, Celeste's family, who had been silent since her body was discovered, finally spoke. Her father, Jesus Rivas, simply said, "Thank God, justice for Celeste." Their attorney, Patrick Steinfeld, said the family is committed to ensuring Celeste's voice is heard and her memory is honored throughout this process. Hochman described the family's grief as incalculable. They attended the arraignment, their first public appearance since losing their daughter. If only that amount of vigor had been there while she was alive to keeping her, I don't know, home, keeping her safe, to keeping her protected, you know, like your job as an effing parent. Burke remains held without bail. The arraignment is expected to proceed with the formal charges now filed. The coroner's report, sealed since November 25, is expected to be made available, which will reveal how Celeste died. And the DA's office will decide at a later date whether to seek the death penalty. There is a lot of legal road ahead, but something Hochman said at the press conference does keep echoing. A parent's nightmare is a situation where your daughter goes out one night and never comes back. Well, she was doing that quite a bit. Celeste Rivas Hernandez went out. She walked into a house in the Hollywood Hills. She was 14 years old. Her parents came from El Salvador. She was reported missing three times, and three times the system meant to protect her let her slip through. She was allegedly in a relationship with a famous singer that was visible on Twitch, on Discord, on Instagram, backstage at concerts, in matching tattoos. And still, nobody with the power to intervene did so in time. And I think, again, that's key. With the power to do so, did so in time. With the power to do so. That means parents. I'm not writing them off. Because they were busy, because they were working, because they're immigrants, because this or that. It's not a free pass, and I'm not going to give it one on this show. There deserves to be some light shown there. And I'm not blaming them for her death, but when a child that age, I have one that age, I cannot conceive of what she was allowed to just go, oh, she's got a boyfriend going out for the night. He's 19. It's like, yeah, may I remind you, you're the parents. She doesn't have free range. She's a child. And maybe that's the sad part of this whole damn story. It appears, in my opinion, that so many people in this case didn't look at her as a child. They treated her like an adult, and she wasn't. And now she's dead because of that. The system that failed Celeste while she was alive is now being asked to deliver something for her in death. Charges have been filed, the most serious charges a DA's office can bring. Whether the evidence hold, whether the system follows through, whether justice actually arrives for a girl from Lake Elsinore, whose life allegedly became inconvenient to some with power, and not something enough to, I guess, pay responsible attention to as a parent, that's the only question that matters now. And it's a question a lot of families in this country have to ask. Most of them never get an answer. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation right there. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our reporting as we continue to follow this case. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Celeste Rivas Hernandez was reported missing three times in 1 year while she was allegedly having some form of a relationship with artist David. She was 13 the first time she allegedly ran. Some reports say that it might have been even earlier than that. By 14, she was allegedly living inside a Hollywood Hills home with a rising music star, 7 years older. The charges against David Anthony Burke are horrific, but the part of the story that should terrify every parent listening is everything that happened before. A child disappeared into a celebrity's world and nobody stopped it. That's where we're going to be again today. Your thoughts, drop them in the questions area in the comment section on Substack, YouTube, Facebook, X, wherever you're watching us. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, is joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. As we dive deep into the mind of David Anthony Burke, known as David. Siobhan, let's start here. Burke's friends thought Celeste was 19 and in college. At least that's what they're telling everybody now. She had fake IDs. She was at clubs. There are people saying she fooled everyone. Why is that such a dangerous narrative in this case right now as we try to understand who knew what and when, that she fooled everyone?
Yeah.
This is someone who was a child.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's just start there.
Go. Yeah, I call BS on that yeah. Everybody thought she was older. You know, she doesn't look older. She looks like a young adolescent, which is what she was.
Yeah.
In the, you know, the live stream video that we saw of the two of them together, she presented as a little girl. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody's just trying to cover their own butts at this point. Oh, we didn't know, we didn't know, we didn't know. And I just don't buy it. I think it's self-serving.
It also doesn't matter in the law either. I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Her age is her age. And so they can rationalize all they want, but it's still illegal.
Yeah.
The verbiage and the stories that are coming out here, we're hearing, oh, her other boyfriend said this, and like from she's a 13-year-old girl. Like, how many boyfriends has she had? What kind of experience is going on here in life? And that's an interesting thing about this case, because from what we understand, it seems that this girl didn't necessarily grow up in the best of environments. She's running away multiple times. That's a whole other conversation. What's inspiring her to constantly run away? But the fact that she kind of had, from what we understand, a hard life, probably grew up a bit faster than everybody else, maybe did act a bit more mature than her age. But that seems to be such a thing with this case. And unfortunately, with young people who end up having to mature before their actual age says that they're old enough, they carry themselves differently. They carry mm-hmm. themselves a little more maturity. And it seems that the adults in the room around don't recognize that, or they recognize it and they accept it when they really shouldn't. Nobody should be looking at a 13-year-old girl and going, oh, well, she's just more mature for her age, so we're just mm-hmm. going to treat her like an adult going mm-hmm. forward. Mm-hmm. That's not okay. That's never okay. And I don't care who you are, especially the parents shouldn't be treating her that way. But it seems everybody in her orbit was treating her that way.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the things, I'm not knocking all men, of course, but I remember being 12 and having predatory 30-year-olds, you know, trying to give me rides home from school. Mm-hmm. And it's very seductive when you're a young teen girl and you're surrounded by predatory men. Yeah. Who will always say, oh, but you look older, you act older, you seem more mature. And as I've talked in my book, I met my first husband at 15 and he was 25 and, you know, and married him shortly thereafter. And one thing I heard from so many people, well, it's okay because you're so mature. And it wasn't okay. And it was pseudo-maturity, you know, it was all a facade. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a problem in our culture where there's a certain subset of men who go after young girls because they have so much power over them and kids can be easily manipulated.
Yeah, I keep getting fixated right now on that word maturity that everyone keeps using with her. And Siobhan, from your amazing book, from your background experience, mine to a much lesser degree, I think what happens is, and as I'm curious about if you agree, in using that word maturity when you're referencing someone who's so much younger, 13, but went through a lot of trauma and has a lot of reps in problem solving. No, I think people are mistaking someone's ability to problem solve because they face so much trauma, they face so many challenges in life that they and no one to rely on, no one to help them feel safe, no one to help work through it. So they're very adept and have life skills at solving problems to be safe, which looks like someone else who wants to manipulate their own mind and rationalize it as, well, they're just mature. No, actually, they're problem solving the chaos in their lives. Is that accurate?
I think that's a really good point. They gain some skills in survival. And so they may at times speak in a way that seems more sophisticated than a 13-year-old. Some 13-year-olds are still playing with Barbie dolls, you know, and others are out walking in the street and getting rides home from predatory men and presenting themselves as older. But it's not insight. It's not real maturity.
Right. And so you can imagine how someone with that skill set, because they come from such a horrendous background, challenging background, especially learning how to travel on your own across a country as a 13-year-old, and now you're presenting to a group of adolescent moron boys that haven't problem solved anything in their lives. You know, they know how to go on TikTok. They know how to make music. You know, it's like apples and oranges. And so it's easy to see how she looks so much different to them because they're idiots. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I used that word completely.
Well, it's so much nicer to say, oh, you're so mature for your age, rather than saying you're so traumatized. Mm-hmm. You have many unnatural survival skills.
Yeah, I mean, that's the first thing you do when you see someone that presents at such a young age with that kind of problem solving skill set. The first thing that pops up in my mind is, what's going on in your life that made it that you needed that skill set? Because basically, we only do things we need to do. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily at that age that you want to do. So, and there's the failing. So I'm going to, I know we're poking at Celeste's family or lack thereof in intervening. Well, what, same thing on David's side, you know, what the hell, where is the parental oversight on this side saying that where us as parents are seeing the red flags go up and say, what the hell is this?
You need to distance
yourself from some crazy here because there's some craziness going on in this life. And you're not the age or have the disposition for an underage minor to be a lifesaver.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's red flags and questions and utter failures of parents all around in this case, it seems. She ran away three times. Let's get into that. Let's talk about her home life a little bit here, what we know or don't know about it. She was 13 and has run away three times. Mm-hmm. Her ex-boyfriend allegedly has said that she was unhappy at home and talked about leaving. The fact that a 13-year-old's even thinking, hey, maybe that's an option. Maybe I should leave. I mean, that's not good in any way, shape, or form. Why? What is a kid that age actually chasing when they keep running? And why is that the exact thing the wrong person knows how to offer?
Yeah, you're hitting on something I think is really important. It's just hard to know what her home life was because, you know, there's one factor that I don't know, and people may be talking about it. I'm not sure at this point. There are kids from very good homes who are seduced by predators online. And mm-hmm. I see that happening so much. And it's really easy to confuse a 13-year-old or a 10-year-old. It's happening with such young kids. And I always say I have such compassion for parents who have kids, and all kids are on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to monitor what they're doing. The kids can get around that parental control software. And I've seen even in very stable, wonderful families, a kid gets hooked up with a predator on the internet and they're manipulated and they may take off. And we don't really know, just because we don't know the family, we don't have enough information. Was she running to something or was she running from something?
Great point.
And kids at 13 often hate their parents. I mean, you know, they just do. My kids, when they were 13, thought I was the dumbest person in the world. Fortunately, they grow out of it, you know, but.
Do
but
they? Good.
Well, they do. Yeah.
Siobhan, you make such really powerful points there that I think people got to keep remembering on this, and including us. You know, when I was working with the Innocent Lives Foundation, we had one of our victims that was very vocal about her experience with her mom. Very, very loving family, very close-knit family, and she was groomed online and then shamed into not sharing what was going on, the whole isolation then, and she was groomed and eventually molested by this online groomer. And finally, it was the mother after months seeing changes and deviations from the communication style her daughter had. She became much more closed off. And so, so it can happen absolutely everywhere. So that is definitely a warning to everyone. It's come from a bad family.
It's a huge warning. And working with so many adolescents over the years, I don't work with as many under college age kids now just because I'm older and I'm not immersed in the culture like I was when my kids were teenagers. And I knew all the musical acts, which my kids were into Nine Inch Nails and Nirvana and, you know.
The oldies now.
The oldies, yeah. It was a different culture, but I understood it all. I'm a little bit beyond adolescent culture. But it's just something that is very, very hard for parents to monitor and understand. And then the other thing I'll mention, because this always just kind of, you know, it makes my head spin sometimes, the different level of resources in families. I have had kids, let's say early teens, in treatment for different things, who had parents that were surgeons, made nearly $1 million a year. They were in private schools. They had tutors after school. You know, when they were little, they had live-in nannies. And they just had a lifestyle where there were so many resources for them. And of course, those parents were in a situation where they could really do an adequate job for their kids. And then I literally would have kids. I had a contract with the Department of Social Services, and I would get very opposite end of the spectrum families in treatment. And, you know, literally, a mom that could not afford the $10 copay for her child's antibiotics for a severe ear infection. And I pulled out the $10 and gave it to her. And, you know, when you're working at McDonald's and another shift at Taco Bell, I think parents really are stretched sometimes. And it's just shocking the difference in outcome between the parents who are highly resourced and their reason for being in therapy is their kid is applying for top tier universities and didn't get in. And so the parents are having panic attacks and freaking out. And the family where the parents are just so exhausted, you know, they mean well, they love the kids, but they're just, you know, they're just depleted. And so I've seen the whole gamut. So I tend to have compassion for those families because I so often wish you know, we had a better social safety net for people, and, you know, and they don't have access to counselors often. They don't know what to do. They do their best, but we're just not all coming from the same playing field. I was on a psychology guest on a psychology podcast yesterday, and there were some brilliant questions. And one of them was, you know, if you're awake at midnight and you can't sleep, what are you ruminating about? And for me, always, I wish I could have resourced my kids better. You know, I wish I could have given them more. I wish I did not have to work so much at night when they were kids. And, you know, when you're starting off as a new clinician, or I had three kids by the time I was in college and a grad student, I wasn't there enough. I tried my best. I love those kids dearly. And fortunately, nobody ran away. And I always said my bar was fairly low. I hope nobody ever gets arrested, you know. But I wasn't the parent that could fly them around the country looking for the best colleges and give them the kind of economic support that I wish I could have given them. And so I just tend to come from that place of compassion and assume that with the resources people have, most parents are doing their best. They don't all have skills. They just don't have the support network that they need. And so I'm just going with a guess in this case that there was some of that going on. And of course, there are, we talk about these other cases where you've got the psychopathic, sadistic parents that hurt their kids intentionally and abuse them and do terrible things to them. But that's sort of a different category than just people that are trying, but they're under-resourced.
You know, that empathetic parent that you're describing is me. I know it's Tony. That's when you're giving it your all. And I've had this conversation. My kids are older too. They're in their late 20s. You know, like, I wish I was more. I wish I'd been there more. Yeah. And I'm always getting a lot of grace from them, thankfully, because, you know, as a dad, they know you're doing all you can. And you will never, ever, when you care with all your heart to be the best you can for your kids, because you know, literally, it's the only thing in life that matters is how they go through life. And after you're gone is how they're living a good, healthy life. That's all that matters. Yeah. And so you'll never be enough in your own mind. But thankfully, we have beautiful kids that give us that grace. And that's why in this case, and you make such great points, since we don't know her family, we don't know her situation, we've heard rumors, we've seen it, what we see on social media, that's why I place so much more responsibility on David's parents. Yeah. So they do have the resources, he has the resources. Why weren't you being the watchdog for people like this, you know, for someone who's going to get, because inevitably, you know, he's going to have people that are going to want to become part of that entourage. You're going to be sucked into that world they want to be part of. You know, so where are them with their awareness to parent their underage guy who's now in his early 20s, you know, from this kind of stupid. So and that's to your point, I think, is that, hey, if you do have the resources as parents, where are you? Why aren't you showing up to see these red flags when they arise so you can prevent stupid things and happening and really tragedy for everyone?
Yeah. And how it's a very different sort of parenting that raises somebody who's that narcissistic and we can say probably somewhat psychopathic, if not very psychopathic, and a predator. And those are, I think, the parents where, you know, it's probably easier to dissect the family and go, okay, we can see some really weird things about, because you have to feed that stuff. Mm-hmm. That's personality development. You know, it's his brain is not fully cooked at this point. But even with that, this is not normal to have a predator as your child. And that, to me, is the ultimate parent failure.
Is the culture that David was living in and really was kind of brought up in, I mean, he was online. His big thing was originally, I think, playing video games. And, you know, and it's for a lot of people that's how they're getting attention. That's how they're getting their followings, is people watching them play video games. I know. But it is certainly a big thing. That sort of culture where it's performative. They're turning it on. Their mic's on. People are watching because they like to see what they're doing on the game and what their commentary is about their game. And then when they go into a chat here or whatever over here, it's turning it on, it's turning it off at a very, very young age and different audiences in each group. They have to know who they're speaking to and how to speak to them to elicit the attention, the reaction, the following that they get. It's a very, you know, it's something that we, as an adult, I know how to do that when we go on the air and we do shows, but that's what we do. I'm an adult. This is, you know, this is the building blocks of life. You're trying to figure it out. Your brain's not fully cooked yet. This is how you're learning to stack things on top of one another as for how you're going to operate going forward. That in itself, is that a dangerous world for a young brain to be in, where it's, I can be very performative here, I can act this way, I can be this person to these people, I can be this person to those people, and I can be this other person to these people. Mm-hmm. Teens and kids, we all have done that to a certain extent. There's only, you know, certain things you say to your parents and certain things you don't. You do have that separated. But is it, I mean, are we ingraining this in such a deeper level than we used to be through social media, through training kids with their performances, if you will, with who they talk to in so many compartmentalized ways? Are we creating a little generation of psychopaths to a certain extent or more likely to go down that road of narcissism? Because they have learned, I have to be this person to these people, I can be this person to those people, and that person to these people, and at the end of the day, it's all about how I feel, and I want to feel good and happy, mm-hmm. and I'll manipulate all these, and I'll pull the levers how I need to get where I need to go, and I'm not looking back. That's a very long question, but is that where we're sitting right now in terms of the atmosphere?
So. Yeah, I think so. I think there's data, I haven't looked it up recently, but that narcissism is increasing in young people, and a lot of that has to do with exactly what you're talking about. Too much attention for the wrong reasons at a very young age when their personalities are still forming and they don't develop depth. You know, it's all about what character am I playing now? And they get high off the attention and the adulation. And it's really concerning. You know, I often say we know that people in the Hollywood film industry, you find a lot more narcissism. And that's what got them there, was this performative nature and this showing off for the cameras. It always just kills me, you know, things that pop up on my news feed with the, you know, the celebrity walk as they stop and they get their pictures taken and the posing and the, it just makes me cringe. It just makes me cringe because what are we celebrating in this culture? You know, we make people celebrities for very foolish reasons.
It's because they're, you know, they think that that 5-second highlight reel that they're seeing from someone else is that life, and they get caught up in the disease of comparison and the cult of more.
Yeah.
And they make that their true identity that they're seeking. And to a lot of our viewers, points, yes, 100%, David is culpable for his actions and is accountable for his actions. I think with the curiosity that we're exploring is how far out does that culpability start spreading?
Yeah.
Because that's what we're really seeing, and it's definitely in the school shooter situations where parents are being more culpable. So we're kind of just exploring, you know, who else is actually should have known more, could have known more. Definitely he knew better from right and wrong, but also who else in this circle? How far out this is a crazy spread?
Yeah, yeah. It would be a fascinating case study to take all that apart. And I think that's what we try to do with our conversations on this show is look at all the factors. Because in truth, when you have a crime, something horrible that happens, it's usually not just one thing. Sometimes it is. And that makes me think of somebody who just had a psychotic episode and did something terrible. And so the psychosis was what caused it. But that's a small percentage of crimes.
Very small.
And most of the time, it's this multifactorial stuff, and it's all the different things that led up to it. And there's a lot of factors involved.
I love that. Multifactorial.
I like what you said.
One of my favorite words.
Oh, you got, you got a lot of words I love to put on. I keep writing yours down.
We'll have t-shirts soon. Don't have depth. I think that that's a very good point, and we're going to get into that here in our next segment. By the way, Siobhan's book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go check it out right now. It is her memoir, and it's phenomenal. Please do go and check that out.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Normally in these ads, you'd expect someone like me to ask you to buy something. But I want to ask you to do something different. I'm Dave Farenthold, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm an investigative reporter, which means that I follow the money, inside of government and outside of government. The point of my job is to find things people are trying to hide. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves looking through lots and lots of documents. And if there weren't folks like me to go beyond the surface to understand who is really shaping what the government does, the public will be left in the dark about what the government's doing with your tax money, what the government's doing to you through regulations and spending. If you're like me and you think this kind of journalism is important, seek out a news source that does firsthand, fact-based reporting. If that's the New York Times, thank you. If that's your local paper, that's great too, because where you get your information matters.